flying the helicopter. It wasn't a bad plan. The camp lay within the shadow of the Kalmadal Mountains. As the only relief facility for hundreds of miles, the site was the major crossroads for the entire region as Somalis from all walks of life, travelers and nomads, came seeking medical help, continually flowing into and out of the place. Because of that, the camp was also a strategic and important clearinghouse for information. It was no wonder the SRR had someone posted on the inside here. With care, Gray's team might learn something vital about Amanda's whereabouts, or at least narrow the search parameters. Back in D.C., Painter was coordinating a satellite scan of the neighboring mountains. Between boots on the ground and eyes in the skies, the hope was to pinpoint Amanda's location before nightfall. Sand suddenly swirled beyond the windows, kicked up as the chopper descended. With a final stomach-lifting drop, the skids finally kissed the ground. Alden hauled the cabin doors open. Sand and heat pounded inside as the roar of the engines whined away. They all exited the helicopter and were met by a medical team of four, who rushed forward to help offload Major Patel. His stretcher was carried away to an idling jeep. Major Butler accompanied his injured partner to make sure he was properly attended and to spread the cover story that their group were foreign aid workers. Tucker patted his dog's side, reassuring the shepherd after the long, noisy ride. Kowalski merely scowled at the grim surroundings.
Once. Just once. Why can't we end up at some beach where women are in bikinis and where drinks come in coconuts?
Seishan ignored him and stood at Gray's shoulder.
What now?
This way, Alden answered, heading off accompanied by the last member of the British SRR team, Major Bela Jain. The captain pointed toward a cluster of thatched roof huts. As a group, they crossed through a parking lot of rusted trucks, skeletal sand rail buggies, and beat-up motorcycles. Guarding them all stood an older Daimler Ferret Scout car, painted United Nations white and emblazoned with their blue symbol. It looked like a mini-tank with a fully enclosed armored cabin and mounted by a Belgian L-7 machine gun turret. A United Nations peacekeeper leaned against the vehicle, eyeing them suspiciously as they passed. Alden noted Gray's attention.
Camps like this need to be protected. Raids are common for drugs, even for water. Drought has devastated much of this region, contributing to famine and death, driving the people to the coasts or up into the mountains.
They reached the circle of huts to find a French doctor kneeling beside a long line of Somali children. A nurse prepped a syringe and handed it to the doctor, who jabbed it into the bony arm of the first boy in line. Gray had read how the civil war going on in the southern part of the country had displaced hundreds of thousands of civilians and their children, leading to outbreaks of cholera, diarrhea, and hepatitis. But a vaccination program against measles and polio, along with the administration of simple deworming tablets and vitamins, was saving countless young lives.
"Here's the contact I was telling you about," Alden said, pointing to the doctor. "He hears everything going on around the camp, misses nothing. He's a great asset."
Gray studied the French MD, a middle-aged man with bulky glasses and sunburned nose and ears. But Gray was wrong about the focus of attention.
"Bashi!"
Alden called out and waved an arm, stepping forward. The spy at the camp winced as he was injected in the arm. The young, dark-skinned boy thanked the doctor in French.
"Merci."
Pulling his tunic sleeve down, the child headed over.
"Ah, Mr. Trevor, you come."
"This is your contact?"
Kowalski mumbled under his breath, plainly not pleased.
"What is he, 14?
13, actually,"
Major Jain said softly. She stared at her superior with raw admiration. "Captain Alden rescued the boy from a group of Muslim insurgents outside Mogadishu. A child soldier. Only 11 at the time, hyped on bloody amphetamines, brutalized and bearing scars from cigarette burns."
Gray's heart ached at the sight of the boy's mile-wide smile as he rushed forward and hugged Captain Alden, who had dropped to one knee. It seemed impossible to balance such simple joy with the horrors Major Jine described. Alden hooked an arm around the boy's thin shoulders and led him back to the gathered group. "Here are the people I wanted you to meet, Bashi." The boy smiled, staring around, but Gray saw the hint of fear in his eyes, a wariness of strangers. He leaned more tightly against Alden. Here were the cracks that exposed the past trauma. Tucker's dog squirmed forward, sniffing, wanting to get the scent of the newest addition to their pack. Bashi's eyes got huge. A small squeal of terror stretched out of him.
Kane, come here, Tucker ordered,
at the sound of the boy's distress. The shepherd returned to his handler's side.
Down.
Tucker reinforced the command with a flat-handed gesture. He sank to a knee next to his dog, but his words were for the boy.
He won't hurt you, I promise. He's a good dog.
Tucker held out a hand, asking the boy to come forward. Bashi remained frozen at Captain Alden's side.
Just let the boy be, Seishan warned. He's clearly afraid of dogs.
Kowalski made a grunt of agreement, even Jine's eyes pinched with concern. Tucker ignored them all and kept his arm up. Seishan looked to Gray for help. He simply shook his head, remembering the man's empathy scores. They had been through the roof. Tucker had a preternatural ability to interpret another's emotional core, and maybe it wasn't just with animals. Clearly bonded to the child, knowing the boy, Alden also seemed to share Tucker's understanding.
It's okay, Bashi.
If you want.
The boy stared at the dog for a long breath, cocking his head, perhaps searching inside himself for that lost bond children had for all things furry and warm. Finally, he stepped clear of Alden's legs, trembling a bit. His gaze never shifted from Kane.
"He good dog?"
Bashi asked. Tucker nodded once. Bashi crept forward, approaching as if toward a perilous cliff. Kane remained alert, only the tip of his tail twitching with excitement. Bashi reached out the back of his hand toward the dog. Kane stretched his nose, nostrils flaring, snuffling. Bashi moved an inch closer. It was far enough. A long pink tongue slipped out and licked the boy's fingertips. The tail twitch turned into a big wag.
"He likes you," Tucker said softly.
Bashi's smile returned, shyly at first, then stronger. He moved near enough to touch Kane on the top of his head. The dog's nose sniffed along the length of his arm. Bashi giggled and said something in a Somali dialect.
"Tickles," Alden translated.
Moments later, the boy was sitting on the ground, ruffling the dog's fur and trying to avoid an onslaught of licks. Gray stared at them both, remembering Kane's savage attack on the commando yesterday. Likewise, he tried to picture the boy with a rifle at his shoulder. In different ways, the two, boy and dog, were both warriors. And maybe Tucker had recognized that such harshness needed an outlet of innocence and play. And also trust. Alden joined Gray.
"Bashi is slowly coming around. The base here works with such children. They try to rehabilitate them, to bring out the scared child still trapped within the nightmares of those past horrors."
He eyed Bashi and the dog, then Tucker.
"You've got a good man there."
Gray had to agree. Tucker stood off to the side, studying the distant mountains. After seeing how the handler and his dog had operated back in Busasa, how the shepherd had tracked Seishan's blood trail through the myriad scents and smells of the city, Gray wondered if it wouldn't be better to simply drop the pair into the mountains, let them hunt Amanda down by themselves, and radio back her location. But that could take days. Days he felt sure the president's daughter didn't have.
10:34 a.m. Kalmadaw Mountains, Somalia. From the shouts and calls beyond the tent cabin, Amanda knew something was happening. She heard the coughing choke of several truck engines, accompanied by the barking of orders. One of the African soldiers burst into the cabin, talked to Dr. Blake, then turned on a heel and dashed back out again. Blake crossed the medical ward and disappeared behind a privacy screen that hid another bed. The outline of his nurse shadowed the screen. They bent their heads together, talking softly. Amanda strained to hear. If she could have slipped quietly out of the bed to eavesdrop, she would have attempted it. But stealthy was not a word that best described her current state. Still, another reason also fired that desire. The outline of the other hospital bed clearly showed someone occupied it. She had no idea who it was. An injured soldier? Another of the medical staff who had fallen ill? Whoever they were, they'd been slipped into the tent in the middle of the night when she'd been sleeping. She woke to find the privacy screen up and the doctor and nurse going back and forth to attend the new patient. All she knew was that it was a woman, hearing at one point a small cry rising from beyond the screen, definitely feminine. But the new patient had been silent ever since, likely sedated. At last, Blake appeared again and headed over to Amanda with a chart in his hands. He must have read her worry. "Nothing to concern yourself with, my dear." He waved an arm toward the commotion going on outside. "It seems someone has been making inquiries as to your whereabouts, practically knocking at our doors." Hope surged in Amanda at his words, stirring the child enough to kick. "Shh," she whispered, rubbing her belly. Having traveled under false papers, she feared that no one knew she was the true target of the midnight raid in Seychelles. She avoided glancing at the cross symbol with the genetic markings, knowing the truth. The high seas kidnapping had not been random bad luck. It had been purposely planned and executed. But now, could someone be trying to rescue me? Icy water quickly doused that momentary hope as Blake continued. "But they'll be dealt with swiftly enough." His eyes settled to hers. "We wouldn't want to be interrupted, especially with such good news in hand." She understood, looking at the chart he held. "You got back the amniocentesis results." Blake flipped through a couple pages. "Your baby tested perfectly. The genetics remain stable, better than we hoped." He smiled at her. "You're about to give birth to a miracle." 11:42 a.m. UNICEF camp, Somalia. Seishan huddled with Gray inside one of the huts at the edge of the hospital encampment. Kowalski and Major Jine kept guard outside, making sure no one overheard their conversation. And considering how loud they were arguing, that wouldn't be a problem.
"Because beef is murder," Jine said. "Hindus believe that God, and if God didn't want us to eat cows, he wouldn't have made them so damn tasty, especially smothered in barbecue sauce."
"That's not an argument. You'd probably eat your own shoe if it had barbecue sauce poured on it. I mean, look at your ass."
"What about my butt? I've seen cows with smaller rear ends."
A sputtering sound followed, then,
"Quit looking at my ass."
Tucker stared toward the door.
"Diplomacy at its finest," he mumbled.
"Your friend out there sure knows how to mend fences." Tucker had been included in the meeting inside the hut, not because his expertise was needed. It was because of the skinny black arm around his dog's neck. Bashi had taken a real shine to Kane, and what had started as terror now seemed a source of strength.
"No, I tell you again," the boy stressed. "I heard no one speak of a white woman in the mountains. Not here. Not at all."
A map had been spread out on the dirt floor. Captain Alden crouched on the far side of it next to the boy.
"Okay, Bashi."
He leaned back and sighed.
"I'm sorry, Commander. I may have sent you miles out of your way for nothing. Word may have never reached here."
Gray stared at the map. "It was a gamble," he conceded. Seishan heard the tick in Gray's voice. Without seeing his eyes, she could imagine the gears turning. He wasn't giving up, not yet. And it wasn't just him.
I can go out again, Bashi offered. Into the camp, ask questions, not just listen.
No,
Seishan snapped. The vehemence of her response surprised her. Still, Gray backed her up. Seishan's right. It's one thing just to eavesdrop and pass on what he's heard, but to actively ask questions will put him in the crosshairs of our enemy. Remember what happened to Amur Mahdi back in Busasa.
And it's not just the risk to the boy, Seishan started. It's more than that.
Gray gave her a concerned look, perhaps hearing the sudden stress in her voice. She gave a small shake of her hand, not wanting to continue, not trusting herself. The boy had already been used and brutalized as a child soldier. How would they be any different if they turned the boy into their spy? It was bad enough that the British SRR was using the kid as an informant. Seishan stared at her hands and found her fingers tightly bound together. She knew how easy it was to twist such innocence to foul purposes as the strong preyed on the weak, twisting children into monsters, turning them into soldiers or scouts, or even sending them ahead of an advancing army as living mind detectors. She forced her hands apart. Her fingers found the silver dragon at her neck. She recognized why the boy's situation struck her so deeply, so personally. The realization made her both angry and ashamed. She remembered little of her own childhood in Vietnam. Bits and pieces, none that included her father. And what she remembered of her mother she wished she could forget, of being ripped from her arms, of her mother being dragged out a door, bloody-faced and screaming, by men in military uniforms. Afterwards, Seishan spent her childhood in a series of squalid orphanages across Southeast Asia, half-starved most of the time, maltreated the rest, until finally she'd taken to the streets and back alleys. It was there, when she was a little older than Bashi, that the guild found and recruited her. Over the course of the next year, the trainers stripped away not only her remaining childhood, but also much of her humanity, leaving behind only an assassin. I was this boy, she thought, abused and tortured into bloody servitude. But she also knew there was one distinct difference between them. She pictured Bashi playing with a dog, carefree and happy. Unlike her, he was still young, malleable enough to rediscover his humanity. She let her fingers drop from the dragon pendant, the memory of her mother dissolving away into faded whispers in the night and soft kisses on her cheek. But even then there had been tears, as if her mother knew she was about to lose her child. The memory sparked a sudden insight regarding their current mission.
She's a mother too, Seishan said, drawing Gray's attention. The president's daughter.
His eyes narrowed on hers, then widened with understanding. His fingers found her hand and squeezed his thanks, then remained there. She stared down, wanting to feel more, but at this moment all she felt was loss. For her childhood, her mother, even Gray. How could she ask more of his heart when she wasn't sure what was left of her own?
Amanda's not only unusual because she's white, Gray explained to the others, but also because she's pregnant.
Alden nodded.
Such a condition is rare in a kidnap victim. Someone might have made note of it.
And hopefully talked about it.
Gray turned to Bashi.
Have you heard anything about a pregnant woman being moved into the mountains near here? Someone with a large belly?
To emphasize, Gray pantomimed a swollen stomach. Bashi twisted his lips in thought and sat quietly for a moment, then slowly sagged.
No, I hear nothing about a big-belly woman with the pirates.
Seishan studied the boy. He stared too hard at the map, kept his attention diverted away. Even his arm fell from around Kane's neck.
He knows something, Seishan said.
Tucker wasn't the only one capable of reading emotions buried under the surface, especially this boy.
I was this boy.
He wouldn't lie to me, Alden said.
He's not lying, Seishan agreed, but angrily. We're just not asking the right question.
Bashi's gaze met hers. Fear shone there. And resistance. How many times had the same emotions warred inside her? Tucker came and sat next to the boy.
It's okay, Bashi. Kane and I won't let anyone hurt you.
A silent hand signal followed, a flick of fingers, a digit pointed at the boy's lap. Bashi didn't see it, but Kane obeyed. The dog came forward and rested his muzzle on the boy's knee. Bashi placed his palm on the dog's shoulders, drawing strength there.
It's okay to tell us, Alden said softly. No one's mad.
Bashi glanced sheepishly up at his father figure.
I no lie. I hear no stories about Big Belly Woman.
I never thought you did, my boy.
But what's scaring you? What are you so afraid to tell us?
He finally broke down.
I hear other stories. Of a demon man in the mountains. He make a place like this.
Bashi waved his other arm in a circle.
Like the hospital here?
Bashi nodded.
But he only look after the big bellies on the woman.
He takes care of pregnant women? Alden asked, repeating Gray's pantomime of a swollen stomach.
Yes, but they say bad things. Mothers go there, never come back. A very bad place.
Tucker patted the boy on the shoulder.
You did good, Bashi.
The boy refused to look up, showing no relief. Gray shifted to the map.
Do the stories say where in the mountains this doctor works?
Yes,
Bashi said, but he still wouldn't look at the map.
Can you show Kane? Tucker said.
The boy glanced from soldier to dog, then slowly nodded.
I show you, but it's a bad place.
As the boy reached for the map,
Kowalski burst into the room. We've got a chopper inbound.
Alden seemed unconcerned.
They have medical drops all the time. Could be another patient, supplies, or... Major Jine shoved past Kowalski and dove inside.
Incoming! Get down!
Gray rolled Seishan to the floor. Tucker and Alden sheltered the boy, pinning him under their bodies. Bashi clung tightly to Kane. A sharp whistling screamed across the roof of the hut, followed by a massive explosion that shook thatch from the roof. Jine returned to the door. Another sharp scream of a rocket erupted. She leaped back with even worse news.
This one's coming straight at us.
Chapter 11. July 2nd, 5:04 a.m., Eastern Standard Time, Washington, D.C. Painter woke to the ringing of his cell phone, a crescendo of escalating notes that set his heart to thudding hard in his chest. He lay in bed next to Lisa, their naked limbs tangled together, his hand resting on the curve of her backside. She sat up with him, going instantly alert, trained from years of being on call at a hospital. The sheets shed from her breasts, her eyes shone in the pre-dawn darkness. She also knew that particular ringtone, set for extreme emergencies. Painter grabbed his cell phone from the nightstand and answered it.
Director, we've got a problem.
It was Cat Bryant calling from Sigma headquarters. He glanced at the clock. It was barely after 5 in the morning. When he'd left last night with Lisa, Cat had still been in the bunker, running logistics for Gray's operation and coordinating the various intelligence branches. Had she ever left?
What's happened? He asked.
I'm fielding some frantic SOSs out of that UNICEF camp in Somalia where Gray was headed. Reports of rocket fire, some sort of attack.
Do we have eyes on it?
Not yet. I'm already working with NRO. I tried to raise Gray, but so far there's been no response.
likely a tad busy. What about support? We have the Navy SEAL team cooling its heels in neighboring Djibouti.
I can get them airborne, but it'll still be 40 to 50 minutes for them to reach that inland camp.
Painter closed his eyes, his mind racing through various parameters and scenarios. If he called in the SEAL team, it could threaten the entire mission, expose his hand too early. SEAL Team 6 had been assigned here specifically to extract the president's daughter, not to play UN peacekeepers.
Do we have any idea who's attacking? Painter asked.
The camp has been raided twice in the last 90 days, both drug runs. And 2 months ago, a doctor got kidnapped by one of the local warlords. This attack may have nothing to do with Gray or the search for Amanda.
Painter wasn't buying it.
He pictured the assassination of Amur Mahdi. The enemy seemed to know their every move.
With all of the various intelligence agencies engaged in this mission, and now the British SRR, something was leaking out.
Painter trusted his own organization, but there were too many cooks in this international kitchen, not to mention the president's family. The leak could be coming from anywhere.
Painter had to make a tough decision. He couldn't lose focus. He had to preserve the SEAL team and its operational readiness for a possible fast extraction.
Director? Cat asked.
He kept his voice firm. Get me eyes in the field as soon as you can, but for now, Gray's team is on their own. A short pause followed. Then Cat responded.
Understood. Lisa's hand slipped into his. She didn't say a word, offering only her warmth. Should I delay the mission to South Carolina? Cat asked.
Painter remembered the scheduled investigation into the clinic where Amanda had her in vitro fertilization performed. He couldn't escape the feeling that Amanda's sudden flight to the Seychelles had something to do with her child. First, the assassination of Amur, and now this new attack on the hospital camp. Somebody intended for Amanda never to be found.
No, he said, glancing at Lisa. We'll head over to Sigma Command right now. I want you both out on that first flight to Charleston.
A longer delay followed. Painter wondered if he'd lost Cat. Then she came back on the line.
Director, I've got a few captured still shots of the camp, from a French weather satellite. They're not the best, but I'm sending them to your phone.
Painter pulled the device from his ear and switched to speaker as he waited for the image to fill the small screen. Line by line, the horror of the situation in Somalia revealed itself. The image offered a high aerial view. Few details were discernible, especially with a thick pall of smoke obscuring most of the camp. Tiny dots represented people and vehicles trying to escape the attack. Overhead, the blurring image of a helicopter hovered above the chaos, like some predatory bird waiting to pick off the weak. Cat's small voice emerged over the speaker.
Did you get the sat photo?
Got it.
Lisa peered over his shoulder, covering her mouth with a hand. Painter struggled to keep to his original plan. It was easier to abandon Gray's team to a bad situation when it wasn't staring him in the face. But no matter how tough or callous, he knew his original decision was the correct one. With a few final instructions, he signed off with Cat and lowered the phone. He stared out into the darkness. Someone desperately wanted to stop Amanda from being found. But who? 12:12 p.m., East Africa time, Kalmadal Mountains, Somalia. Dr. Edward Blake held the radio handset to his ear. He stood in the communications tent, crammed with gear and festooned with satellite dishes. The swelter of the day drew beads of perspiration down his forehead. But he knew all of that sweat was not from the heat alone. He even held his white safari hat in his other hand, not because he was indoors, but because of the presence at the other end of the line. Few personages ever intimidated him. He had been raised in an aristocratic family in Leeds, whose lineage included earls and dukes, all distantly related to the royal family. At estate dinners throughout the ages, their home had hosted famous figures of past and present, from the wartime leader General George Patton to entertainers who had been knighted by the Queen. In Oxford, his roommate had been a billionaire's son, a prince out of Saudi Arabia, a deadly man who would eventually head a Muslim fundamentalist group until he'd been caught and hung. Still, none of that affected him or impressed him. Not like now. Edward's fingers tightened on the handset. The voice on the other end was computerized, masking the identity of the speaker. Edward had no idea to whom he spoke, but he knew the power behind that cloaked voice. It was somehow appropriate the voice was computerized, because he knew he was speaking to a vast machine, a powerhouse that had moved throughout the ages, destroying all in its wake and retooling the chaos to suit its ends. And Edward wanted to be more than a cog in that vast machine. He intended to drive that massive engine. It had been luck that landed Amanda on his doorstep. His egg-harvesting clinic, one of many in this region, had been chosen to facilitate this matter. But it would take his skill to turn that good fortune into an opportunity to move up the ladder. To achieve that, he needed success. "The problem is being addressed," Edward promised. "The Americans will never reach the mountains in time."
"And the fetus?" the voice asked.
"The DNA is stable, as we all hoped." He dabbed the sweat from his brow with the back of a sleeve. At least that was good news. Plans could move forward, behind schedule, yes, but still salvageable. Edward continued. "As to that other matter, I can perform the C-section immediately. Get things ready."
"Very good."
Though the voice was flat and effectless, Edward imagined the satisfaction behind those inhuman inflections. "And what of the mother?" Edward asked, suspecting this was a touchy matter. The answer came without hesitation.
"She's no longer of use. Her death will serve a greater purpose."
"Understood." The voice moved on to exacting detail about how preparations and procedures would continue from here. One last item concerning the mother was addressed.
"Burn her body. It should be unrecognizable."
The sweat down his back went cold. The pure callousness both appalled and excited him. What would it be like to move through the world with such utter disregard for morality, driven only by purpose? The call finally ended. Lost in preparations, he vacated the communications tent, strode through the sun-speckled glade of the camp, and up the steps to the makeshift medical ward. He tried his best to wear such a mantle of amoral drive as he stepped through the door and let it clap shut behind him. Petra glanced up, shifting a fall of blonde hair, her face open and questioning. Edward looked beyond her to the hospital bed at the back of the ward. Amanda stared at him. He must have failed to fully don that cold mantle. Something must have still shone in his face. The patient pulled her legs up, an instinctive desire to protect her child. "But it's not your child that needs protecting at the moment." Edward turned to Petra. "Get everything ready. We're doing this now."
Chapter 12. July 2nd, 12:15 p.m., East Africa time, UNICEF camp, Somalia. With the blast still ringing in his head, Tucker pulled the dazed boy to his feet. Kane shook off dust and pieces of thatch. Smoke and sand floated in the air. The air reeked of burned flesh and flaming fuel. The rocket had hit outside the hut, collapsing a corner of the clay brick structure. A large blackened crater opened a few yards away. Bodies lay strewn at the edge, tossed and torn like so many rag dolls. Tucker found his breathing growing heavier, flashing back to prior firefights in Afghanistan. He pulled the boy's face into his chest, not wanting him to see. Bashi didn't resist. Though deafened, He still felt the boy crying in terror, feeling his racking sobs. Captain Alden groaned and rolled to his rear end. Blood covered half his face, but it appeared to be only from a scalp wound. He must have caught a piece of the blast debris.
"Get him out of here!"
Alden yelled, flopping his arm weakly toward the door. Others rose out of the smoke, shedding rubble, bearing cuts and abrasions. Gray stumbled forward with Seishan. Kowalski helped Major Jine to her feet. She wobbled slightly but found her footing.
"You okay?"
he asked. She shook free of him, teetered sideways, then grabbed his arm again.
"Maybe not."
When the Indian woman spotted her captain, she still tried to go to him, concern on her face. Alden waved her off.
"Go with them, Jine. Help them get clear."
"What about you?" Gray grabbed the map from the floor and passed it to Bashi. They still needed the boy to pinpoint the secret medical encampment rumored to be up in the mountains. Even rattled, the commander never lost sight of the mission objective.
"Captain, you need medical attention."
Alden grinned through the gore.
"Then I guess I'm bloody well at the right place, aren't I, Commander?"
He teetered back to his feet. "Besides, I've got two men here. I'm not leaving them until I know they're safe." "Or dead," Tucker added silently. Punctuating that dour thought, another blast rocked deeper into the camp. Kane flinched, ducking lower. Gray grabbed the captain by the upper arm.
"You'll do your men no good on your own."
He dragged the Brit out the door. "Come with me." Alden looked ready to argue, but Major Jine backed Gray up.
"Commander Pierce is right, sir."
"Maybe we can argue later,"
Kowalski shouted at them by the door.
"Chopper's swinging back this way."
"Out of here, now," Gray ordered.
The captain reluctantly followed. They rounded the hut and moved out among the field of parked vehicles. Tucker guessed where the commander was taking them. He would have done the same, to utilize every resource to survive. Gray led them straight to the mini-tank, painted white and emblazoned with a UN World logo. The Daimler ferret-armored car still sat where they'd seen it earlier. The peacekeeper posted beside it had climbed into the turret, manning the machine gun. The weapon smoked from prior shots, but the helicopter was currently beyond range on the other side of the camp, although it wouldn't take long for the chopper to circle back around. Gray called to the peacekeeper as a handful of refugees fled to either side of them.
"You're a sitting duck up there, soldier. You need to get this vehicle moving. Help defend the camp."
The man, dark-skinned and helmeted, yelled back in a French accent. He was young, likely not even 20. Fear frosted his words.
"I am alone. I cannot shoot and drive, monsieur."
Gray turned to Alden.
"Here is how you can best help your men. Put this tank in motion, draw the chopper's attention, and take that bastard down."
Alden understood.
"I'll do what I can to cover your escape."
Captain pointed to a pair of sandrail buggies 50 yards away. The skeletal dune runners looked perfectly suited for this rough terrain.
"If there are no keys, they're easy to hotwire. Just jam something sharp into the ignition and twist to get them started."
The captain's next words were for his fellow soldier.
"Stay with them, Jine. Get them all clear and I'll see what I can do from here."
The major looked exasperated, but she knew how to take orders and nodded. Gray shook Alden's hand as they parted ways.
"Be safe.
You do the same."
The captain stopped long enough to give Bashi a fast hug.
"Do what they say."
I will, Mr. Trevor."
The captain nodded and climbed into the armored car. Gray hurried them forward, ordering them to secure their radio earpieces in place. Ahead, the sandrail cars were little more than engines strapped to roll cages with some seats bolted in place. They had no windows, fenders, or doors. But Tucker had played with them back in the dunes near Camp Pendleton. Their advantage was a low center of gravity and high flotation tires perfect for skimming over sand and hopping over obstacles. Kowalski must have had a similar experience and rubbed his palms together as they reached the vehicles.
"Which one's mine?"
Machine gun fire erupted behind them. They all leaped forward and split on the run, dividing between a smaller two-seater, which Gray and Seishan commandeered, and a larger four-seater with a bench in the rear.
Jine reached the driver's seat first, but Kowalski wasn't having any of it.
"I'll drive," he yelled.
"Listen, boyo, I've had plenty of tactical driving, and I didn't just get a concussion, so move it, sister."
She looked ready to bite his head off, but she was still wobbly on her feet. She finally relented and abandoned the driver's seat to Kowalski. He discovered a screwdriver already jammed in place in the steering column, serving as a key. Judging by the roar next to them, Gray started his vehicle with no more difficulty. Jine took the passenger seat up front, leaving the rear bench to Tucker and the boy. Kane crouched between them, panting, flinging a bit of drool in his adrenaline-fired excitement.
"Hang on!" Kowalski yelled, grinning way too big.
The buggy leaped forward like a bee-stung horse, just as an ear-shattering explosion flung a nearby truck into the air. Another rocket blast. Tucker twisted around. Behind them, the helicopter roared out of the camp and aimed toward them. An M230 chain gun on the chopper's undercarriage chewed across the sand, chasing after them. But they weren't defenseless. The ferret-armored car raced into view, as fleet-footed on its large tires as its nimble namesake. It crossed into the path of the attack helicopter. From the mini-tank's turret, the machine gun chattered, firing up at the bird in the sky. Captain Alden manned the weapon himself, shrouded in gun smoke and swirls of dusty sand. The mini-tank skidded around to face the diving helicopter head-on. Rounds cracked into the chopper's windshield, driving the bird to the side as the pilot panicked. The armored car spun a full circle and took off, driving wildly through the parked vehicles. The chopper twisted in midair and took off after them, like a hawk after a fleeing rabbit, or in this case, a fleeing ferret. Tucker settled back around, looking forward. Kowalski hit a ridge at full speed and jumped the buggy into the air. The driver hollowed his joy. Tucker and Bashi flew into the aluminum half-roof over the bench seat. Tucker managed to get hold of Kane's leather collar as they crashed back down. The dog growled angrily, ready to bite someone. Tucker couldn't blame him. He glared at the back of Kowalski's stubbly head, suddenly wishing he were back with the rockets and chain guns. It would be safer than this back seat. No wonder Gray had fled to the other buggy. He was no fool. 12:48 p.m. Maybe this wasn't so smart. Gray's buggy twisted sideways down a steep hill, made treacherous by loose shale and slippery scree. He broadsided a patch of brittle bushes at the bottom of the slope and crashed through them. Seishan ducked away as thorns and broken branches exploded through the open roll cage. Once clear, she yelled at him,
"Make for the gravel road we saw from the air! That's what I'm trying to do!"
He had set off overland initially, thinking the road would be too obvious an escape route if the helicopter decided to give chase. He'd already spotted other cars, trucks, even camels fleeing up that road, driven all in the same direction by the attack. He didn't want to be trapped in that traffic jam if there was a firefight. His original plan was to travel as far as they could, then cut back to the road. But the hilly terrain proved tougher than it looked, broken up into rocky hummocks, sudden cliffs, and thick patches of bushes and trees. Ahead, it looked even worse as the land pushed up toward the mountains. Risky or not, the road had to be safer than this. With that in mind, he drove the car up the next rise to get a better view and gain his bearings. In the rearview mirror, he spotted Kowalski following him, and farther behind him, an ominous column of oily black smoke marked the horizon. Let's hope that's the helicopter.
There, Seishan pointed.
He turned his attention forward. A quarter mile away, the road looked little better than a dry riverbed winding across the bitter terrain. It disappeared into the higher hills and scraggly lower forests. Kowalski skidded up next to him. Gray touched his throat mic as he nosed his vehicle down the far side of the rise.
Kowalski, we're heading back to the road. We'll make better time there.
Too bad, his partner responded in his ear. It was just getting fun.
From the white-knuckled grips of his passengers, Gray doubted they'd describe his driving in such a positive light. Though the Dune Runners were made for spinning, jumping, and turning, all necessary skills to traverse this torturous terrain, it still felt like riding a jackhammer on top of a cement mixer. And the last quarter-mile journey back to the road was no gentler on his kidneys. At last, he fishtailed his buggy onto the gravel, which, after the off-road trek, felt as smooth as a freshly paved highway. He sped gratefully down the road, which climbed in sweeping switchbacks up into the mountains. Over the next hour, he kept a hard pace, passing the occasional slower truck. The forest slowly grew thicker and taller as they gained elevation. Rounding a sharp turn, he came close to a head-on collision with a camel. The creature dodged around the buggy with a plaintive complaint. Gray noted the empty saddle and the bundle of gear tied to it as the beast continued downhill. Worried, he slowed his buggy to a stop. Kowalski flew around the corner with a rumble of his engine and a throaty grind of gears. He came close to rear-ending Gray, but swerved to a halt in time. Gray cut his engines and signaled Kowalski to do the same. In the silence, Gray strained, then heard a distinct pop, pop, pop. Rifle fire. He pictured the empty saddle. Ambush, he said. Seishan immediately understood, too. Someone set up a roadblock ahead. They're sweeping up after the helicopter. Gray nodded. Any refugees who attempted to flee into the mountains were being gunned down ahead. But another cold certainty settled in his belly. It had been nagging him since the first rocket blast. He had hoped the air attack had been orchestrated by local insurgents or warlords. Drugs and medical supplies were as good as gold here, especially in the war-torn south. But this ambush on the road into the mountains removed any uncertainty. This was about Amanda Gant Bennett. And worse. This is too bold a move for pirates, he said. The chopper attack, now this roadblock? They're not trying to hide their actions any longer. They're pulling out the big guns and making a final stand. What are you getting at? Seishan asked. This isn't defense. This is an end game. He turned to Seishan. They wouldn't move so openly, so brazenly, unless they saw no further need to keep their mountain enclave secret. Realization dawned in Seishan's eyes. Either they've moved Amanda already, she started. Gray finished. Or she's dead. 1:48 p.m. Amanda tugged against the padded their mountain enclave secret. Realization dawned in Seishan's eyes. Either they've moved Amanda already, she started. Gray finished. Or she's dead. 1:48 p.m. Amanda tugged against the padded leather cuffs, tying her to the hospital bed. Minutes ago, they'd placed an IV catheter in her right arm and given her an injection that fogged the edges of her mind. A saline bag slowly dripped next to her. She wanted to panic, but couldn't. More than the drugs, what kept her calm was the steady beeping of a fetal heart monitor. The nurse had strapped a sensor belt around her belly. It communicated wirelessly to the bedside device. My baby's fine. My baby's fine. It was her mantra to keep her sanity, especially with all the commotion in the room. Blue-smocked medical personnel came and went, busy behind the privacy screen of the other bed. Elsewhere, soldiers hauled out equipment under the direction of Dr. Blake. Movement to the side drew her muddled attention to Petra. The nurse hauled a portable anesthetic machine to her bedside. At the sight of the clear mask hanging from the hoses, Amanda fought against her cuffs, but she was already too weak. Dr. Blake came over and touched her wrist. He raised a syringe filled with a milky fluid. Don't worry. We won't let any harm come to your baby. She was unable to stop him as he inserted the syringe needle into her IV line and slowly pushed the plunger. Petra lowered a mask toward her face. She twisted her head away. Across the room, she watched one of the medical staff push aside the privacy screen. At long last, she saw who shared the ward with her, who lay in the other bed. Horror swelled through her. She screamed as Petra grabbed her head and forced the mask down over her nose and mouth.
Now. It'll be all over in a few seconds, Blake promised her. 3, 2.
Darkness closed around her, narrowing her view of the world to a pinpoint.
1.
Then it was gone. Chapter 13. July 2nd, 1:55 p.m., East Africa time, Kalmadal Mountains, Somalia. Gray paced the shoulder of the road while the sun baked the gravel into a shimmering mirage. He and the others kept to the shadows of the neighboring forest. It sang with the buzz of cicadas and the call of songbirds. Farther up into the highlands, green forests beckoned, draped in mists, like a sliver of Eden. Emphasizing this, the occasional breeze carried down the scent of wild-growing jasmine. He clutched a satellite phone in his hand and weighed the risks of opening an encrypted communication channel to Sigma Command. From the series of attacks, both in Busasa and here, intelligence was clearly leaking to the enemy. And right now, his team had a thin advantage. No one knows we're still alive. Gray wanted to keep it that way. But more than that, what would be gained in the end if he reached out to Sigma? What support could they offer? To mobilize an adequate response would risk exposing both their survival and their location. Even SEAL Team 6, awaiting word in neighboring Djibouti, couldn't be activated. Such an overt force had a limited window to get in and get out safely. It was up to Gray's team to first pin down the whereabouts of the president's daughter. If Gray attempted to call the States, and if word should reach her captors that his team was closing in on her position, the enemy would be more apt to act rashly, to kill her on the spot. Knowing what he had to do, Gray shoved the satellite phone back into his pack. We're on our own until we find her. With that settled, he waved Seishan over to him. She approached with Bashi, a hand resting protectively on his shoulder. Gray noticed how defensive she was with the boy. He had never seen her bond so quickly to another person. Gray knelt in front of Bashi. Can you show us on the map where the other hospital camp is hidden? The one with the bad doctor? The boy looked down at his toes and shook his head.
I know, can't.
Bashi looked scared. Gray imagined the gunfire must have spooked him, likely triggering memories of other firefights he had been in as a child soldier. Kane could probably help soothe those rattled nerves, but Tucker knelt with his dog at the edge of the forest, suiting his partner up in a Kevlar vest. The pair readied themselves for a reconnaissance mission, to get some eyes on the ambush ahead and ascertain what sort of force lay between them and the mountains. Farther away, Kowalski and the SRR woman, Major Jine, had returned to the last switchback, blocked the road with their two buggies, and turned away any vehicles trying to use the road to get into the mountains. Jine knew the native dialects well enough to persuade them to take a different route. Though Gray suspected Jine's pistol and Kowalski's rifle did most of the persuading for them. Gray had to admit the British major was an asset, and considering how she handled Kowalski, matching him toe-to-toe, she was one tough soldier. They would need that ahead. Gray returned his attention forward. The best chance for Gray's small team was to slip past that enemy line unseen. They didn't have the manpower for a full frontal assault. But once past that roadblock, Gray needed to know where to go, and fast. The clock was ticking down for Amanda. He was sure of it. He leaned closer to Bashi and coaxed those large dark eyes to face him again. We won't let anyone harm you, I promise. The boy's face hardened, offended.
I know afraid.
Of course you're not. I know Captain Alden is very proud of you, so then why don't you show me on the map where the secret camp is located?
Bashi sagged, crestfallen, and admitted the reason for his reluctance.
I know half the map.
Gray hid his shock, not wanting to scare the boy. He had given Bashi the topographic map back in the hut so he could study it. Where is it?
Bashi's eyes looked wet with pending tears. He waved toward the way they'd come.
I know have it. Blow away.
Gray realized the boy must have lost it during the rough trek here.
It's not his fault, Seishan said. If the rattling had gotten any worse, I might have lost a filling or two myself.
She was right, and Gray knew where the true blame lay. He'd not been thinking when he'd trusted the map to the boy. Bashi looked so much older than his few years, aged by his rough treatment. But Gray also knew this wasn't his first mistake during this mission. The hard glint to Seishan's eyes suggested those errors hadn't gone unnoted.
But I show you,
Bashi said, brightening. He tapped the thumb against his skinny breastbone.
No map, but I map. I take you there.
Seishan fixed Gray with a resolute stare.
We can't put the boy in such danger. We don't even know what lies ahead.
He nodded and glanced to Tucker and Kane. We'll wait to see what they discover. We'll only move forward if there's a safe path around this ambush. 2:02 p.m. Tucker knelt in front of Kane. He pointed into the forest and touched a finger to his lips. From here, they needed the utmost stealth. He roughed up the fur of the shepherd's neck and stared Kane in the eyes.
Who's a good boy?
The dog touched his nose to Tucker's.
That's right. You are.
Tucker felt the other's eyes upon him. He didn't care, unabashed by the display of affection.
Let's go,
Tucker commanded and held up five fingers, instructing Kane to keep 5 meters ahead of him. Together, they moved into the deeper shadows of the forest. Kane slipped away, vanishing with the barest rustle of leaf. Tucker followed, stepping carefully, letting his dog take the lead, becoming an extension of his senses. In his earpiece, he heard Kane's quiet breath, along with the whisper of birdsong and creak of branches. He kept one eye on the shielded screen of his phone that gave him a survey of the upcoming terrain from a dog's point of view. They slowly, but steadily, paralleled the road through the forest. Kane's night vision camera stripped away shadows, making sure they didn't stumble upon any sentries hidden in the forest. But more than the night vision, Tucker trusted his partner's nose. When Kane slowed, so did Tucker. When the dog circled wide, Tucker kept the same wide berth. Though separated by several yards, they moved in tandem, like a choreographed ballet. All the while, Tucker radioed soft instructions via Kane's earpiece, keeping the dog following the rough turn of the gravel road. Through the sensitive microphone on Kane's camera, harsh voices suddenly reached Tucker's ear.
Slow, he subvocalized to his partner. Creep. Left.
The view through the camera dropped low. Forward movement became a step-by-step approach back to the road. The trees grew thinner. 3 trucks, all Land Rovers, appeared ahead, blocking a choke point where the roadway had been blasted through a steep ridgeline. Soldiers paced in front. More stood on the hoods. Other men rolled vehicles to the side of the road or dragged bodies, leaving bloody trails. The entire force wore black vests, helmets, and carried assault rifles. Same as the crew who had assassinated Amur Mahdi. Tucker counted at least 15 men.
Down, he instructed Kane. Stay.
He touched his throat mic and reported to Gray.
Commander, do you see this?
Affirmative. We aren't getting through that logjam without a major firefight. Can you find another path around them?
Do my best.
He left Kane to guard his back, to maintain his post by the road. Earlier, while en route here, he had heard the faint tinkling of water through his dog's microphone. He crept through the woods slowly, heading away from the road, searching for the source. It didn't take long to discover a thin stream of water trailing along a sandy gully. It flowed only a foot wide and only a few inches deep, runoff from the highlands, the last vestiges of the rainy season trickling away, so small it would never reach the arid plains below. Still, he dipped his finger into it, remembering an old adage of his survival training instructor. Where there's water, there's a way. He headed upstream, hoping for that to be true. Within 50 yards, the feeble wash reached the steep ridgeline that blocked the way forward. There he bore witness to the power of water, even a flow as anemic as this one. Centuries of wet seasons had slowly eroded a cut through the sandy rock. It was narrow, dropping through a series of shortfalls, easily climbable, giving them ready access to the highlands above. Focused upward, he failed to note the figure kneeling by the pool at the base of the cataracts, filling a canteen, a rifle resting beside him. Tucker had forgotten his other survival training instruction. Never let your guard down. 2:13 p.m. The heat of the day, even in the shade, wore on Gray. He kept a watch on the phone screen, viewing the feed from Kane's camera. The assault team remained a quarter mile up the road. He watched the mill, heard their harsh laughter. But at any time, they might send a scout or one of the trucks down this way. They needed to be gone before that happened. He checked the clock on the corner of the small screen. Tucker had been gone for 10 minutes. No word. That was long enough. He raised his fingers to activate the radio mic at his throat. Before he could speak, a rustle drew his attention back to the woods. Seishan raised her pistol. Tucker shoved through some bushes and into the open. His eyes had a wounded, tired look. "Found a way," he said. "Let's go." Gray quickly gathered the others. He and Seishan flanked Tucker as they hurried into the forest. Kowalski and Jine followed, with Bashi between them. The woman had an arm around the boy, intending to keep him safe. "Any problems?" Gray asked Tucker, sensing something troubled the man. "Only a small one," he said sourly. They reached a tiny creek and followed it uphill, moving as quietly as possible. The waterway led to a steep ridge, eroded throughout by a series of cataracts. "Who is that?" Jane asked, pointing the muzzle of her rifle at a soldier gagged and hogtied, out cold, sprawled beside a small pond at the base of the falls. Seishan moved warily closer, searching the remaining woods. "He's alone," Tucker said dully. "Came for water. But someone could come looking."
"Why didn't you just kill him?" Kowalski asked. "Hide his body."
Tucker mumbled.
"Almost did kill him. Caught me by surprise."
Seishan dropped to a knee and examined the soldier, then glanced at Bashi. Her voice held a sharp edge.
"He's only a boy."
Gray got a better look at the soldier's face. He looked even younger than Bashi.
"I jumped him," Tucker said, breathing harder. "I moved fast, barely thinking. Didn't want him to alert the others. Had my arm around his